This is the Financial Exchange with Barry Armstrong and Mike Armstrong. Your exclusive look at business and financial news affecting your day, your city, your world. Stay informed and up to date about economic and market trends. Plus, get breaking business news every day. The Financial Exchange proudly supports the Disabled American Veterans Department of Massachusetts. Learn how you can support our great American heroes by taking part in this year's DAV 5K on Saturday, November 6th. Visit DAV5K.Boston for more information. Now, it's time for the Financial Exchange with Barry Armstrong and Mike Armstrong.
Stocks are trading lower this morning, but the price of oil is up just a tad, 77 cents a barrel at 62.68, and interest rates are on the rise ever so slightly. Good morning, everybody. It's Barry and Michael with you here on a Tuesday, and we thought we were going to have a positive open to Wall Street today, Michael, but it turned the other way in the last hour or so.
Yeah, big earnings week, and I think a lot of digestion just happening here in terms of a slew of companies set to report. We've got some big ones after the bell today. We had some, you know, pretty substantial ones yesterday, so Tesla, UPS, Snap, all reporting, and a number of them, I guess, just missing expectations. I mean, Tesla had the most profitable quarter it's ever had, but wasn't quite up to snuff, and it's not selling off dramatically, but down 3.5% this morning on those those pieces of news. So I think, you know, investors are looking at this, and you know, we see the markets are not off substantially, by the way. Dow is off 27 points, less than a tenth of 1%. The Nasdaq's leading the way down. And I think perhaps, you know, with Tesla and Snap disappointing a bit, whereas UPS, for instance, beat, that reopening trade seems to be continuing here, where tech, you know, is having a lackluster year compared to years past, I guess. And those Dow components and the those that are participating in this idea of reopening are continuing to do well. Although I guess UPS is an interesting one, right, where, you know, very much benefited from the pandemic and deliveries occurring, but you know, apparently still riding that gravy train forward at this point.
Yeah, you wonder if habits are going to revert back and people will order less online. Hard to imagine that's the case, but that may be what you know, investors are anticipating with UPS, right? That, oh, they're going to slow down now because people aren't going to shop online as much. I'm not so sure. Once you start the habit like that, it gets pretty easy to consume whatever it is you're looking for. I did want to talk about Tesla. You mentioned them in your opening there. And, you know, when you look at their sales and their revenue and their earnings, you say, oh, on the surface, it looks pretty good. But then I dug into it, Michael. You know, they sell a lot of their regulatory credits, you know, for the clean air to other auto producers. So they made a ton of money doing that.
Let's explain what that means for a minute, too. So these regulatory credits are effectively these credits that companies need to meet certain emission standards. And so if you're Ford and your best-selling vehicle is the F-150, then you are not meeting the emission standards set by the U.S. government. And therefore, you're required to go out there and buy basically the excess supply of those credits from a company like Tesla. And so Tesla sells these quarter after quarter. It's been one of the big critiques of Tesla from, you know, anyone that's shorting the stock. They'll point this out to you, which is Tesla doesn't actually make any money selling cars. They make all their money selling regulatory tax credits.
And I think the question there is how much longer will they be able to do that? Because Ford is coming out with their own electric vehicles. GM is doing the same thing. So the companies that they're selling these credits to are not going to have an appetite to buy them in perpetuity.
Presumably not. Yeah, I mean, it really depends how successful any of those companies are at actually marketing, you know, their electric vehicles, whether or not they are actually any good. You know, I haven't seen a single Ford Mach-E on the road, and I saw three Teslas driving one by one behind each other on a small rural road around here the last few weeks. So, you know, Tesla still makes up, I think in 2020, they made up 70% of the electric vehicle market. So how much of a dent do these other automakers start making, and how much did that eat up? I mean, for Tesla, it's a race against time, right? Can they get to scale to be able to really, you know, produce this stuff on a profitable basis? Can they cover their fixed costs and get to a sizable production scale to cover all these fixed costs that they have in time for these regulatory credits to go away? The other big piece, by the way, so if you take a look at Tesla's quarter, right, they had profits before taxes of $518 million. Their revenue from, or excuse me, the total profit, was it 518?
Yeah, 518.
Yeah, sorry, 533 in pre-tax income.
Yeah.
518 million of that came from these regulatory credits. There's really no associated expense there, right? That's 100% profit. $101 million came from the sale of Bitcoin. So they purchased a bunch of Bitcoin in February. They sold a bunch in this quarter.
So that means their earnings were really negative. They would have lost money without those two bumps, right?
Now, like, correct.
You can't count on making $100 million a quarter off of Bitcoin.
No, right? You can't. You can count on those regulatory credits for probably a few more years, though.
I don't know. GM is rolling. You know, GM is starting to sell these things, these electric cars. Don't you think they're going to get in line?
No. I mean, 2 years, 3 years from now, maybe.
Okay.
But I mean, when you think about GM, it's just not, you know, a big enough portion of their fleet to make a dent here.
True.
So I just don't think it's anytime soon. But yeah, I mean, Tesla, if you're looking at this, you're right. They lost money on their car making business. They have lost money on their car making business since they started, though. This is nothing new. My bigger concerns with Tesla aren't so much will they break a profit on their actual vehicle making. And, you know, there are other businesses, right? You know, their solar business is pretty yep. significant at this point as well. I think they will at some point. My concern is their growth trajectory. We talked about this a little bit yesterday. They're facing some new issues in China that I think perhaps investors aren't fully pricing in here. Did you cover it all, or did you read anything about the protest at the auto show in China on Tesla?
I did not.
So it was one woman that basically broke into an auto show and protested Tesla's vehicles, saying that her father died in a car accident when the vehicle should have braked mm-hmm. and didn't. And you know, again, in the United States, this wouldn't really be a big story. But the fact of the matter is, this occurred in China, and the Chinese press reported it significantly. They moved that story all over the place. They asked big questions. Lawmakers started asking questions of Tesla. And so, you know, if you're reading into this, which I am, my read into this is that China is using the standard playbook here. They've had Tesla in their country, within their borders, for a few years now. They've
got a good look at all their
technology.
Learned
what they've needed to learn, and now they're starting to make those moves to call into question, you know, Tesla's safety procedures and whether or not they're really the right company to be doing business in China. This protest would have never heard the light of day were it against a company like NIO, who also, you know, manufactures electric cars mm-hmm. in China and just happens to be owned by the Chinese.
A lot of my friends have lost a lot of money, though, Michael, trying to short Tesla stock.
Yep, and I cannot stand here and be a proponent of doing that, because I think that Tesla still has enormous growth potential in other parts of the world. But, you know, China has been a key component of their growth plan, and I would call that into question. Whenever any business is relying on China as a key component to their growth plan, I would very much call that into question based on what we have seen time and time again.
Who do you think their number one competitor is to Tesla? Volkswagen?
Yeah, I do. Volkswagen would be the single biggest one that I could think of. I don't think that they really compete with them today, but if you're talking about somebody that has the ability to both compete on the higher and lower end,
right,
it's probably Volkswagen, who can put out, you know, a nice Audi as well as a low-end Volkswagen model to compete on the lower base prices. But I think they're far, you know, we showed last year that they were far away from that. They tried to roll out, I'm not remembering the name of the Volkswagen car that they rolled out, but They rolled out this vehicle that, you know, checked the boxes in terms of being an electric vehicle, but mm-hmm. they realized quickly that the appeal of a Tesla is not just that it's got a battery in it. You know, they realized pretty quickly.
It's the image.
It's the image. It's the style. It's the constant updates that go to the vehicle automatically, rather than having to bring it into a servicer to go, you know, upgrade the vehicle. It's a whole lot of other things that go along with it. And Volkswagen rolled out this car, I think it was the ID3 or something like that, that only checked the electric vehicle box and didn't sell. And so they're having to rework all of that, re-engineer it, and, you know, think a little bit more like Tesla. And that's their advantage as far as I see it. You know, they mentioned, just like every other vehicle production company, the semiconductor shortage. And they did have to shut down their plant for a little bit in Fremont, but they were able to so quickly pivot to new types of semiconductors to just different processes that it really didn't inhibit their production line, whereas Ford and GM have just been completely clobbered by this because, you know, they've got facilities all over the globe, and they are built to deal with the supply chain that they have, whereas Tesla is very small and can quickly shift production.
Big changes coming at Apple as it relates to your privacy. Do you own an iPhone? We're going to be talking about that in the next segment.
Wall Street Watch, a full update on the market's performance to date. Weekdays at 10:30, only here on the Financial Exchange Radio Network. There are many priorities to consider when creating an estate plan, and one of the most important is protecting your family's assets. How and when to leave assets to your beneficiaries is a more complicated process than you think. So don't make snap decisions or take chances that could affect you for generations to come. Learn what you need to know in Todd Lutsky's brand new guide, which is available now. It's called How to Leave Assets to Your Beneficiaries, and in it, he'll discuss several strategies that can help you make the right decision at the appropriate time. There's a new federal estate tax exemption of nearly $12 million. That could lead to a larger inheritance for your family members. But don't celebrate just yet. Call 866-848-5699 and get your free guide today. Avoid unnecessary mistakes that can be extremely costly if you aren't careful. Todd is an expert in elder law and taxation, and he's been helping families like yours with their estate planning needs for more than 30 years. Call right now. 866-848-5699. Again, that's 866-848-5699. Or download the guide from his website, LegalExchangeShow.com.
We want to hear from you. Text keyword Barry to 63566 and let us know what you think about the stories we discuss. You're tuned to the Financial Exchange Radio Network.
The next update that you receive from Apple could include some privacy changes that will... Well, they're going to help Apple, but they could sure hurt a lot of other companies, especially, you know, you look at the impact this could have on Facebook, Michael. It could be enormous.
It could. So I guess let's go through what the changes are on this new iOS 14.5. Have either of you, Tucker hasn't downloaded. I don't have an iPhone, so I'm a bad source on this. Have you downloaded it, Barry?
Hasn't been sent yet for me.
I think you can manually do it.
It should be available for you, Barry, but let me double check.
Yeah, but usually
mine.
They send you a little notification saying, hey, we're going to update tonight at midnight, and I haven't gotten that yet.
So what the new iOS does is it requires any application that does data tracking, which is all of them, to go in and receive a pop-up notification when that application tries to track your data across different platforms. And so what's going to happen is you are going to get a little pop-up on your phone. It's going to basically explain to you what the app is trying to track and ask you to opt in or opt out. Previously, you could do this on your own, but you'd have to go into the application settings and decide what they're allowed to track or not. That was an opt-out system. This is an opt-in system where they are going to require you to say, yes, I want this to happen, or no, I don't want this to happen. And Barry, Chuck and I were debating this yesterday, and my sense was that most people are going to go ahead and opt out. I mean, that right. would be my sense, but I honestly don't know. I mean, I am not really sure if most people are just going to ignore it and, you know, quickly say allow, or if they're actually going to read through this and understand what it means.
I think what you may see, it depends on the application, right, that you're looking at. So if you look at your phone and it's the weather app, you may say, well, no, I'm going to stay in. I want to get the updates and I want to get the information from that one. But you may look at another app on your phone, like CNBC, right? I've got that on my phone. I'm not sure I want every update that they send out because they send out a lot.
Well, it's not the updates, Barry.
Well, the ads that they generate, too.
It's not even that. They're going to still be able to send you ads. They're still going to be able to do all of that. The only thing that Apple is asking is, hey, can the weather application see what you're doing when you're going over to your Facebook application? Can the weather app go look at your search results when you put them into Google? That's what Apple is asking.
So this is the exact wording, and this is just pulled from the Wall Street Journal example. You pull up an example, Dunkin' Donuts. It says, allow Dunkin' to track your activity across other companies' apps and websites. And the options are ask app not to track or allow.
Yeah.
So my feeling is that a lot of people are just going to be like, well, no, don't track me. I don't want that. But it's just like, I mean, is anything really going to change?
I just don't know. I'm very interested to see what people actually select here. And the second piece that I'm interested in is, okay, let's take Dunkin' here. Will they make changes in their application to make it more difficult to use if you say don't allow? Because hypothetically, they could do that, right? I mean, I think it'd be fairly easy for Dunkin' to make some changes so that if you say don't allow, maybe they don't automatically load your location and show you the closest Dunkin' Donuts. Maybe they just make it a little bit glitchier to use that application, and then 3 months later, they put another pop-up notification in there to say, hey, we can't do this, that, or the other. Change your settings to be able to allow us to track location or track your information across applications again. So it'll be interesting to see what actually happens here, because like I said, my initial inclination would be to say, yeah, shut it down. Don't let them track me. But I don't know. You know, the one thing I've learned is that most people around in this country do not care about privacy. Most people in the world don't care about privacy. And so, you know, if it makes anything a little bit more difficult to use, it might just, you know, people might just say that they will allow it. You are correct. You know, Facebook here will not be able to micro target in the way that they have. And this is where they make, you know, all of their $84 billion in revenue. The other thing, though, that I think is being overlooked, and we will see how this plays out, is this is a selling point for Apple's advertising business, which is tiny.
Right. Right?
They made $2 billion in advertising last year. And, you know, yeah, you can argue that, hey, this is all because Apple wants their users to have more control over their privacy. And there's an aspect to that. There's also a portion that makes it so that Apple looks like a far more attractive advertising partner here. You know, they've got all the data now. It's not that nobody has the data. It's just now that only Apple knows what you're doing across all these different applications on your phone.
Right, right. It's so. How do you think this ends up playing out? I mean, Facebook, you talk about a devastating blow to their business. Has Facebook stock suffered?
No, and I think the answer why is it's because people don't really know how this is going to play out. I mean, Facebook has a ton of data on you already. And, you know, again, it's not that Facebook can't track what you're doing. They can still look at, okay, when you open that Facebook application, what did you search for? Whose profile did you look at? When there are ads on there, did it catch your eye? I mean, you don't even have to click something on the Facebook application. If you just stop scrolling through that feed and hover over an ad for another minute, they learn a ton about you. What they don't know now is what you're doing when you go over to Spotify or what you're doing when you go over to Amazon, whereas they used to.
Yeah, that's huge. And I'm not sure it's necessarily a good thing either, because let's say you're shopping for something on Amazon. You know, you might get competitors to that product following you on Facebook saying, don't buy that pair of jeans, buy this pair of jeans.
Right. That's
or don't buy the hot tub you were looking at on Google. Come buy this hot tub.
Well, that's the status quo today. And I guess my question is whether or not those types of advertisements are actually effective, because
I think they're very effective.
Do you? Because
yes,
I find that nine times out of 10, when those are being advertised to me, I've already purchased the item.
Oh, I disagree. I find that whenever I'm looking for, you know, a new clothing or something like that, or a new grill or something, I don't buy it, but I still get teased by it every single day. And I'm just like, oh, yeah, let me take a look at those sunglasses again or whatever it is.
Well, we'll see. We will see how truly devastating this is to Facebook's business. They are clearly the number one target here. I mean, they are the worst offender when it comes to all this stuff. They really designed the entire strategy when it comes to, you know, tracking users across multiple different applications and building these profiles. And again, it does not mean that Facebook won't be able to target you and build ads to your specific preferences. It'll just require a lot more guesswork.
And they're going to have limited information as opposed to what they used to have. Right?
Correct. Yeah. So again, in that example, if you go pop open Amazon and go search for that grill, Facebook will have a much more difficult time figuring out that you were searching for that grill on Amazon's application, whereas it used to be just very, you know, it used to be a matter of fact. They could look at it and physically see that you are searching for that grill. They might still be able to insinuate that information by just your browsing history and, you know, information on your demographics, but they won't know that you looked for that. So that's the big difference here, and I don't think anybody really knows what that means for Facebook's bottom line, other than the fact that there's probably more competition coming from Apple.
Is there anything on the update that will stop political ads from coming through on Facebook?
You can do that now.
How do you do it?
You gotta go into the Facebook settings.
Yeah, unsubscribe.
unsubscribe.
Come on, Barry. That's lazy. Go to Facebook, check your settings, and you've got a whole slew of different things that you can choose what you do and do not see in terms of advertisements on your profile. You can't stop people.
Well, it's not just ads. It's like political opinions from
Just mute everyone. Mute them all. You don't have to unfriend them. Just mute them all. It's the best thing going.
All right. Markets are open. We'll give you a full update from Wall Street when we return. In addition to that, we're going to be talking about the supply squeeze. You hear about it every day, and we're going to talk about it in detail.
Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at TFE Show. Breaking business news is always first, right here on the Financial Exchange Radio Network. Time now for Wall Street Watch, a complete look at what's moving markets so far today, right here on the Financial Exchange Radio Network.
This segment of the Financial Exchange is brought to you in part by Stony Brook Water. There's no more refreshing drink than ice-cold, clean water, and the new Ion Coolers from the Stony Brook Water Company provide that pure, fresh, incredible taste with every glass. Get the new Ion Water Cooler from Stony Brook Water for your office. Order by April 30th and receive a 20% discount on installation. You can call 978-381-1476 or visit stonybrookwater.com/trial. It's time now for Wall Street Watch. We're joined by Brendan Hayes from the Armstrong Advisory Group. Brendan, modest sell-off on Wall Street this morning. We thought we were going to open up in the positive, and we've got pretty much red across the board at the moment, but nothing substantial.
Yeah, right across the board, but it's certainly been mixed. You know, we had the Russell 2000 in positive territory for a little bit. The S&P is barely down, right? Down by 0.09%. It seems like we're just taking a pause after yesterday where the S&P ticked up to what was really all-time highs during the trading day. But, you know, investors right now, they're waiting to see some additional corporate earnings results. We've got the Fed Reserve monetary policy decision-making meetings coming out starting today. So it's a two-day meeting. Right now, we're seeing Tesla off a little bit. Sales results didn't hit. So, you know, some of the earnings that are going to come out, the big tech names, they're starting today and later this week. I think that should really get things going. You know, realistically, when you look at those FANG stocks, with the exception of Google, you're not really seeing the rest of that gang really making any headway in a number of months. You know, you're talking 6, 7, 8 months that they've really been treading water. So I think the market's just taking a little bit of pause to make sure that the Fed doesn't recognize, you know, some sort of inflationary pressures, because they've made it pretty clear that they're not going to make any changes until they see, you know, in writing that inflation is going up substantially.
Few companies were better positioned to profit from consumer behavior changes due to the pandemic than UPS. Their stock went on an absolute tear last year when folks realized just how much people were spending on online delivery and things of that nature. I don't think a lot of people expected it to continue to this point. UPS stock up nearly 12% this morning. What did we hear from their earnings call?
Yeah, having a great day today. Clearly, you know, you're looking at a company that, you know, when you go back in time, really their stock price was range bound for over 5 years. You know, really couldn't break out. But you know what they've just reported is that they had revenues of $22.91 billion for the quarter ending March 21st. So, you know, everyone kind of assumed that, yeah, last year, really good year, but it's continuing along, and it's really beat estimates by, you know, 10, 12%. You know, their year ago revenue was only about $18 billion, right? So you're talking about an additional $4 billion or over 20% increase in revenues. You know, they hadn't really come out of the gates as strongly this year as the overall sector, right? The Dow Jones Transportation Average was up about 20% year-to-date. And with this increase today of that 12%, it puts UPS actually right in line with their peers. A couple interesting things about UPS. They actually were started out in 1907, and they're based out of Atlanta. Today, they have over 273,000 employees worldwide. with 127,000 cars, vans, what I thought was interesting, tractors and motorcycles delivering those packages. You know, right now they've got a PE, a forward-looking PE of 19.72 with a 2.32% dividend. So, yeah, a lot about UPS today out there.
My most interesting fact about UPS, their drivers almost never make left-hand turns. It's fascinating. Almost never do they make left-hand turns, and it sells them, saves them millions of dollars in fuel every single year. It's just fascinating study in logistics. Brendan Hayes from the Armstrong Advisory Group joining us for Wall Street Watch, and in particular taking a look at the United Parcel Service ticker symbol on them. You guessed it, UPS. Thank you, Brendan.
All right. Thank you, Mike.
We can't leave us hanging like that on the left-hand turn story. How does that save me fuel?
Turning against traffic, you often have to wait for that left-hand turn.
Yeah.
So you know,
that's amazing.
You got to cross a lane of traffic. Unless you're on a one-way street, taking a left-hand turn just takes extra fuel because you're crossing a lane of traffic. You have to idle the vehicle. So they literally map out routes for the drivers, so they almost never make a left-hand turn.
Or they just huck the package out the window if it's on the left-hand side.
No, they don't.
No, they don't. Oh. That was very cost-efficient.
Yeah, it's you know, I'm sure that FedEx has a lot of the same stuff, but this was really, you know, for years this has been a big thing that they have, you know, kind of talked about, and just the logistics they have behind designing routes and just how efficient they are with it, and I found it fascinating.
All right, let's talk about the supply chain. It's clearly broken. We're going to do a segment in the next hour. In the next segment, we'll do an interview with somebody who's going to talk about some of the supply chain issues. But it's affecting a lot of things, Michael. You talk about housing prices. You talk about automobile prices, automobile availability. The supply chain is broken, and it doesn't show any signs of improving dramatically, anyway, for quite some time.
Yeah, and so. Look, we're going to be talking about this, and I made clear, you know, over the last week that, you know, while we've got all these companies reporting earnings, what I'm most interested to hear from those companies is how they are talking about input costs across their businesses. And we can talk about the shortages in lumber, price increases in copper, you know, plastic price increases, and you know, the issues from the Texas storm that drove up nat gas prices, and all sorts of things that occurred there. And I look at all of those, and while they ring alarm bells, to me, those are not the concerning pieces. Like, you know, the fact that lumber prices are through the roof seems to me that would, you know, clearly be a temporary problem that's going to be resolved rapidly. When I look at inflation, there are two potential issues that really keep me up at night. The first one is the shortages story. And so when we talk about shortages, again, you know, we have this in lumber, but I don't see that as, you know, a real issue here. What I am talking about when I talk about shortages is the semiconductor industry. And you know, I'll try and keep this short because we could probably talk about 1970s inflation for an entire show. But I would argue that the real contributor to that period of inflation, really the only other big period of inflation that we've seen in modern history in the U.S., was the shortages that struck the United States supply chains of oil back in the 1970s, and the fact that they couldn't be resolved for years. And what that caused is consumers to say, okay, there's a shortage of this product. I don't know when I'll be able to get it again. And so price is not really relevant to me. I will buy whatever I can at whatever price because I might literally not be able to get it tomorrow. And if the shortage of semiconductors gets to the point where it has in some markets where, you know, maybe you can't buy a car, you can't buy a washing machine, you can't buy a TV, if it causes those types of supply shortages and consumers start buying into this idea that, hey, the shortage is so severe that I might not be able to buy this next product, that could lead to severe long-term inflation that could, you know, really inhibit this economy. But again, it's as much a psychological thing as it is an actual physical shortage of goods. The other piece that I think we need to keep a very close eye on, and you know, there are good parts to this as well, is the wage inflation piece. You know, when you talk about lumber prices increasing, they can come right back down once you have lumber supply come online. When you talk about copper prices or even semiconductors, right? I mean, those prices can come back down if supply comes back online. Labor's different, right? Labor is inherently different insofar as if I start making $17 an hour, I am going, and you know, all of a sudden, the you know 3 million people that have been avoiding getting into the labor market decide to do so. More like 8 million people, but you know, however many people are sitting on unemployment rolls decide in September that they're going to get back into the labor market, and there's more competition. I'm not likely to just go out there and accept a $15 wage if I was making $17 an hour previously. Whereas lumber prices will absolutely do that, and so wages are sticky. And if companies are willing, you know, are needing to offer higher wages right now because there is a labor shortage, which we are seeing in several key industries, it will be incredibly difficult for those companies to lower their wages 6 months from now. It's right. just very, very unlikely.
Yeah, it's going, hard to go down.
Going yeah. through layoffs is difficult. You know, it can be done well, around the edges. But
it's also a lot of what you're talking about, Michael, is demographics. We'll come back to that topic because up next we're going to be joined by Dan Duvall. He's a principal broker and partner at Elevated Realty. He's going to talk to us about what's going on in the real estate market. And speaking of supply chains, well, the supply chain is impacting the cost of new homes. That's next.
Business and financial news affecting the markets and your wallet. We got it all straight from Wall Street, right here on the Financial Exchange Radio Network.
Perhaps the most important aspect of any retirement plan is how to deal with taxes. And with the new tax policy set to be proposed by President Biden, it's time for you to learn about how his new policies may affect you. Hi, this is Barry from the Armstrong Advisory Group. At the core, President Biden's tax plan is an increase on those making over $400,000 per year. Biden's plan would also lower the estate tax exemption from nearly $12 million to $3.5 million. And it would hike the corporate tax rate from 21 to 28%. There's a lot of changes to review, so get our brand new guide that's available right now called The Biden Tax Plan, Fact or Fiction. It'll help you understand these and other proposed changes to the tax code. Call 800-393-4001 and get your free guide today. That's 800-393-4001. You can also download it from our website, armstrongadvisory.com.
Securities offered through Securities America Incorporated, member FINRA SIPC, and advisory services offered through Securities America Advisors Incorporated. Michael Armstrong, representative. Armstrong Advisory Group and the Securities America companies are unaffiliated.
If the Wall Street roller coaster has you scratching your head, check out our brand new podcast, Dumb Questions for Smart Money, an easy way to gain some knowledge about the latest trends in the business and financial industry without the brain pain that comes with it. Listen and learn to Dumb Questions for Smart Money. Subscribe today on Apple, Spotify, and all your favorite podcast apps.
This segment of the Financial Exchange is brought to you in part by Southern Airways Express. Now with flights from Hanscom Field off 95, if you live north or west of Boston or in southern New Hampshire or Maine, Hanscom Field is the hassle-free way to get you to Nantucket. Southern Airways Express, fast flights, low fares. Book today at iFlySouthern.com. We're joined by Dan Duvall. He's principal broker and partner at Elevated Realty, a full-service luxury sales and leasing brokerage focused on the Boston luxury and new construction condo market. Dan, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So maybe you could paint for us a picture of the Boston, I guess, luxury and smaller home market today. You know, has demand, I guess, my big question, shifted in any meaningful way compared to pre-pandemic? We've all been hypothesizing about what, you know, demand for city living is going to look like post-pandemic. What's your take on how things have shifted since then?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny the way things have gone, right? It's kind of been a little bit cyclical. There's been ups and downs. So, you know, take a year ago or a little over a year ago when the real estate market in Boston basically came to a screeching halt.
Right.
Like, there was a point where, you know, things were shut down for a couple of months. And then as we kind of emerged from the darkness and we got into the fall, the market picked up a lot. So I think what was happening was that because of where the suburbs were at on pricing, the bidding wars, the lack of inventory, I think a lot of especially young professional home buyers that might have no kids or one kid are like, hey, I'm not going to overpay for a property in the suburbs when realistically I still want to be in the city. So we saw a lot of influx kind of come back really after the election, and the market was very strong kind of at the end of last year. And then now with all of the people getting vaccinated, you know, those numbers going up, there are a lot of people back in the city looking for property. And the good thing is, at least in the city on its own, is that inventory is there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as what we're seeing here is a dichotomy between a real lack of inventory anywhere outside of the city. It's just insane.
Yes.
In Boston, though, a lot of these new construction projects, especially that were delayed because of COVID, are coming online now, and you're seeing a big buyer appetite for new construction right now in the city. So it's a good sign.
I heard stories, you know, as significant as, you know, people renewing leases and getting, you know, months off equivalent to, you know, 30% discounts in terms of, you know, rental prices in downtown Boston. Are prices, from what you can tell, are prices pretty much back to where they were pre-pandemic?
They're not there yet. And you're absolutely right, by the way. The concessions, especially at the beginning of this year, for larger rental buildings were insane.
Yeah.
2-3 months free, you know, no security deposit. Basically sign today and you get a luxury apartment for half the cost. You know, they're starting to come back now. Like those concessions are definitely kind of a thing of yesterday. They're not happening as much now because of the influx of people coming back. But there's still some deals to be had. But I think, you know, by the end of summer, when we get into that September 1st lease cycle, people are going back to school. You're going to see those numbers kind of come to where they were or maybe even come up a little bit.
We hear stories in the suburbs these days of institutional buyers competing with individuals in the real estate market. That's kind of always been a story in the, you know, from what I could tell, in the luxury multifamily space in the cities. But I don't know what happened during the pandemic. Are you seeing significant, you know, investment from pension funds and, you know, foreign pension funds and things like that that are bidding up some of this real estate right now?
It's funny you mention that because I was asked this question the other day as well, and we're not really seeing it boots on the ground level. Like, we're not. I know there have been a couple stories mentioned about, you know, pension funds buying large swaths of single families in the suburbs.
Yeah.
I don't even think that's a possibility, only because there's nothing to buy.
Right.
And then in the city, we're not really seeing the large groups of condos being bought by a single, either institutional or foreign buyer, like it was when, you know, some of these larger towers were going up downtown, like Millennium Tower or some of the other new developments. So we're not seeing that as much lately, no.
Dan Duvall is principal broker and partner at Elevated Realty. If you want to check them out, Dan, I believe it's elevatedboston.com.
Elevatedboston.com.
Dan Duvall, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
I'd be curious to see what happens with the construction of these, you know, luxury condos, Michael, if it continues. You know, a couple of years ago, you would have 10 or 15 cranes in the sky. Now, you know, it's less. And you wonder if the demand is still going to be there. If people are, you know, because once you buy a house in the suburbs, it's not like you're coming back in, are you?
Maybe. I've actually read some stories about this where, you know, people moved out to the suburbs and have pretty significant buyer's remorse. So I'll be very interested to see how much buyer's remorse there is by people who, you know, moved out to the suburbs or to more rural areas and say, yeah, I did all this when the pandemic was occurring and Boston was, you know, a terrible place to live. Now it's reopened and I kind of miss my low maintenance, you know, 2-bed, yep, 1-bath condo. We'll see. I've heard those stories. I haven't really seen anything though to certainly hasn't, you know, dwindled demand for suburban real estate. I agree. I'm interested about the, you know, the construction market. You know, certainly the input costs and, you know, all of that is going to inhibit future growth.
Because the other thing to remember is you have a lot of office space in town that could end up being converted to residential as well.
Yeah, I guess that would be my question is, yeah, you might not see new buildings going up, but it's not like it's cheap to convert a commercial office,
true,
space to a residential tower. You know, that's a lot of work that needs to go in terms of installing kitchens and splitting up the space and completely restructuring how it's all set up. So I don't believe that construction workers will have any lack of demand anytime in the next decade. But yeah, very interested to see that, you know, clearly there were parts of the housing market in Boston and other cities that hit a dip during the pandemic. But my perspective had been, and it sounds like Dan would agree, that most of that has been eaten up and, you know, we're pretty close to where we were pre-pandemic in some of these major cities.
Well, and the kids will be coming back to school in the fall. A lot of kids didn't, you know, you didn't have nearly as many kids, students, college students in town as you had in prior years. And I think a lot of those kids will come back. So that's going to increase the demand for housing. And he said that the discounts on apartments have already come to an end, right?
They have. But I guess he also made a very good point, which is, you know, compared to the price increases that you've seen in the suburbs, you know, you're not seeing that in the city. And so if you're looking at an apples-to-apples basis, yeah, prices might be back to where they were pre-pandemic, but they're not up to the extent that rural and suburban communities are.
One thing that could derail real estate prices pretty rapidly would be rising interest rates. Right now, the yield on the 10-year Treasury note is 158, and that, of course, is a benchmark for mortgage rates. The Dow is down 26 points. The S&P is down 3 points, and the NASDAQ is right now off 46 points. The Financial Exchange with Barry Armstrong, Michael Armstrong, and Tucker Silva will return in just a few minutes.